In reference to the Jon Irving interview.
Hey, Greg, this is Lipbone Redding, big fan of yours and avid listener of the Higher Side Chats. Listen, man, I think you handled yourself like a scholar and a gentleman on that last interview. Man, just keep it up. You're a great interviewer, man. Don't give in to the haters out there.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Hello again, Higher Side Chatters. Hello again, indeed. Wow, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood, and today we're talking with the great David Matheson and looking behind the Federalist Movement in terms of religious and ancient texts, the loss of their true esoteric meaning, and how this entire sector of human consciousness and human understanding was wiped away by the infiltrators of the giant killer robot that was the Holy Roman Empire in one of the most far-reaching and influential forms of mind control known to man. And it's all going to make sense soon enough, but I wanted to clear up a little confusion out there in the THC audience about the schedule, because I used to always say a show every 5 days, and then we'd have the Money Bomb winners on the episodes that ended in five. But since I've been doing the plus thing and I stopped numbering the shows, I'm cutting it back just a little, because a show every 5 days is 6 episodes a month. But now, instead of doing 6 1-hour shows a month, I'm doing 5 2-hour shows. So it's almost double the content for those who want it, and we get much deeper into every subject with every guest. And then we'll also keep doing the Money Bomb every month on the last show of the month, on the fifth show. So almost the same. But that is the THC schedule. 5 shows a month, which is roughly 1 every 6 days, but always 5 a month. And $5 to sign up at thehiresidechatsplus.com and get those extended shows. I like the math on that. It's simple and easy. And Plus is doing great, but if it starts doing well enough that it can be my only bread and butter, then maybe I can start doing 7, 8, 10 shows a month. I mean, why not, if that's all I have to concentrate on? But you probably don't want that anyway. You might get burned out either way. I have also heard the pleas of the folks who had some issues with the new way of listening to THC Plus, and now there's a simple option for everyone. You can stream it right from the mobile-friendly site, download the MP3s for later to listen to offline, and we also have a rock-solid system of custom RSS feeds for all subscribers to THC Plus, which has been the number one requested feature by far. And I know they work on a few different apps on both iPhones and Androids. There's a listening frequently asked questions on the Plus site that has a lot more details, and I'm working intimately with Stitcher. And it seems like we might be able to come up with a custom option for people who want to listen to the 2-hour shows, the extended shows, and still want to use Stitcher. So that should be coming soon. And it looks like we're doing pretty damn well for a stoner who doesn't know much about HTML and works as a one-man team. So I'm pretty satisfied. That said, if you like this conversation with David and you'd like to hear it continue along with all the other shows I do here, sign up for just $5 a month. That's almost nothing, and or $10 if you like to get in on the monthly Money Bomb money giveaway also. And you can do all that at thehiresidechatsplus.com. So I'm going to make a short and sweet ad for that, so you won't have to listen to me ramble through it every week, but I got lazy today. I found an entire torrent pack of Robin Williams movies, so what are you going to do? But here we go. Enjoy the show, pack your glass, and park your ass, people, because we're talking ancient secrets of the natural universe, the shackling of humanity's collective mind, the rigid world of literalism and Newtonian physics, a boring world in which imagination and mysticism is left only on the fringe, and that's where we are, folks, securely on the fringe. So let's look at those things that shall not be named with David Matheson.
The Higher Side Chats is where it's at.
Folks, today we're taking another stab at understanding the great codes of ancient texts, the secrets of the elite, and the true history of some of the world's largest power structures on our never-ending quest for enlightenment within the darkness. We know that the elite's war on human consciousness is as old as history itself, rooted in religions, structures, and ideas that are still prevalent even thousands of years later. Well, our guest David Matheson has been diving deep into history and ancient texts, looking for the occult knowledge coded within, the manipulation of the powerful puppet masters, and the lies we've been told throughout time. And now David has emerged from the rubble with a 400-plus page new book called The Undying Stars, The Truth That Unites the World's Ancient Wisdom and the Conspiracy to Keep It From You. I can't wait to talk to him about it. Here he is, the code cracker himself. David, welcome to THC.
Well, thanks for that introduction, Greg. I don't know. Now I'm going to spend 2 hours trying to live up to what you just said.
You got to grab them. You got to grab them right out of the gate. But yeah, man, this is going to be fun. Thanks for being here. For the folks at home, David and I had tables right next to each other at the Secret Space Program Conference, and I heard many compelling conversations going on between people who walked up and David about his book, and we talked about doing a show, and here we are. But I've read the book. I thought there was a ton of interesting info in there. I mean, a lot of stuff that's been coming up with other guests I've had recently, mainly the idea that these ancient myths and the stories in the Bible are not to be taken literally, but are actually accounts of the movement of constellations and astrological alignments. And from there, your book covers a lot more ground even still. And I thought it would be kind of fun to dive in by reading just a part of the inscription you wrote in the copy you gave me, where you said that all the conspiracies start here. And I love it. It's a very provocative and bold statement. But let me have you elaborate on that a little bit to get us started. Where do you see all the conspiracies starting, and what got us in this mess?
Right on. Well, you know, I'm really thankful for that synchronicity where we were right next to each other. I wasn't really familiar at all with the Higher Side chats, and then so that was pretty amazing. And then here we are, and I'm wearing the shirt that you gave me here.
Oh, awesome.
So all the conspiracies start here. I mean, what's the Higher Side chats all about? It's about consciousness, right? And it's about this war on consciousness. And it's like, you know, there's the dark side of the force, and there's, you know, the other side of the force. Well, yeah. So I think, you know, one way of all the conspiracies start here. If you want to talk about the New World Order, and certainly that's a valid topic to talk about, but really you've got to know about the Old World Order, because I would say I'm focusing on really ancient stuff, or pretty ancient stuff, mostly around the time of the Roman Empire. Mostly around the time of the movie Gladiator, in mm-hmm. fact, which had these actual historical figures. You know, there's Commodus, the bad guy. There's Marcus Aurelius, the old emperor at the beginning, who wants to give the empire to, Russell Crowe, right? But that didn't happen. Russell Crowe never became the emperor. Well, in fact, right around that time, there was a power struggle taking place over. I believe the empire was being taken over from the inside by a group of people who knew how to create reality. And by create reality, I mean using symbols, using words, using rituals, and using an understanding of the way the world is actually put together, the way the cosmos and the human experience actually works. They knew some deep things about creating reality, and they use that knowledge from a very unlikely beginning to actually take over the Roman Empire from the inside and stamp out a lot of this ancient knowledge that had been very widespread before, and to impose a literalistic kind of system of mind control on the empire using, you know, a combination of military. They had the military might, but they wedded it up with this system of mind control. And then they went around stamping out kind of all the Jedis, right?
Yeah.
So, and that world order has basically been, in effect for 17 centuries. And basically the places that the Roman Empire conquered is where they stamped it out. And everywhere else is where you find some vestiges of this ancient wisdom are still in effect, like the shamanic things that are going on in South America or in the Native American cultures of North America, or in the mountains of Tibet, those are places that the Roman Empire never got to, right? So that's right. Where people who are living, descending from the Western Roman Empire, are going, oh, you know, there's something missing. I want to go check out what's happening with this Native American teacher. I want to go learn from this Tibetan teacher. Why? Because they're hungry for something that actually was part of Western culture, if you go back far enough, that was deliberately stamped out and given, and a replacement was put in place.
Yeah, and that replacement being literal Catholicism is, you know, so many people today still believe Jesus was a real person, you know, he died for our sins, and there are varying degrees of this, of course. We all tend to laugh in the mainstream at those few people who still believe the earth was like 6,000 years old, stuff like that. But there's different degrees of believing this lie, and it's pretty prevalent today. I'm sure most people in the audience have at least one parent or grandparent who is still stuck in that paradigm. And it seems like you yourself came from a pretty conservative background. I mean, you were in the military for quite some time, graduated from West Point, and I've heard you say that you took the Bible literally for almost 20 years, and you even wrote a previous book from a literal perspective. But I bring this up because it just seems like a really hard thing to get over. And a lot of people probably can't sit down with that one member of their family and talk to them about it. So, I mean, how did you overcome this? How did you see beyond that level? What was this process like for you?
Yeah, so great. So let's get right into it. And so you started off by saying that was Catholicism, but let's not just pick on one.
Sure. Christianity
group, right? And really, I would say it's literalism, because, and it's not just Christianity either, because, and I'm just want to kind of set some of the definitions up front, because I think it's both the church and the nobles or the politicians or the elites in conjunction with each other. So you had, at least in Western Europe, you had certain families and bloodlines controlling the crown or the dukedom or they were in the nobility. That's the political side of it. And they were also controlling the mechanism of belief, that being the church. So it's both, it's not just the religious side that's creating reality or that's enforcing a structure on the people, saying, hey, you have to call this guy my lord, you have to call this woman my lady, and if you don't, we'll make life hard for you, and eventually if you continue to persist in not calling him my lord, we'll cut off your head or whatever we're going to do. So and that's a form of mind control, right?
Right.
Eventually, if you say, well, I don't want my head cut off, so I just have to start calling that guy that, eventually your mind will actually, by saying that, you will actually start to create a reality in your own thinking that person is above you. Okay. So anyway, it's not just the church. It's the church in conjunction with political power that did this. But now let's get to your, kind of set the stage here at the beginning. But then you said, most of us in the mainstream would have a hard time believing that anyone could believe the earth is 6,000 years old. And I'm going, hey man, 3 years ago, I would have said, look, here, let me explain. I'll try and be fair to how you could believe that. Is it possible that there's an omnipotent divine being that created the universe? Sure, that's a possibility, right? Okay, I mean, we have to explain all this somehow, and it's pretty difficult to explain. So if there is an omnipotent being that created everything, could he give his word and preserve it? Yes, he could do that, or it, or she, or whatever pronoun is appropriate. Yes, they could do that. Okay, and if the Bible is in fact preserving that revelation, then is it is it right to study it and try and honestly understand what it's trying to tell us? Yeah, that we should spend time trying to do that. Okay, is it possible to believe that the earth is only 6,000 years old? Or we've got people talking about light years away of this. Well, couldn't God create the beam of light when he created everything so that we didn't have to wait 70 billion years to see the stars? Well, yeah,
it's within the realm of possibility,
right? So but yeah, so my own personal journey was that I found that the scriptures of the Bible really did answer a lot of questions about things I found in myself, really did answer a lot of questions about things I found in the world. I believe that they are, I still believe that they are true in a very profound sense, but I don't believe anymore that they were literal. And by that I mean, I believe these are all metaphors, just like the Matrix is a metaphor. It's telling us something, right? The Matrix, you know, everybody right. everybody watches the Matrix and goes, whoa, right? What's that trying to, boy, that explains a lot of things about life. But you don't actually have to believe that literally there's a guy named Neo or a woman named Trinity and go, hey, I wonder if Trinity has any sisters. I wonder if there's any, you know, descendants of Neo around today, right? But you have actually people saying, having big philosophical and theological arguments as to whether there are actually brothers of Jesus or not, whether there are any direct descendants. Did Jesus and Mary Magdalene have direct descendants, you know, Da Vinci Code? Well, you wouldn't think of doing that about the movie The Matrix. You would say, whoa, what are you talking about? You wonder if Neo had an actual brother and maybe we can go meet some of his descendants. You're missing the point of the movie. Just watch it as a movie, right? And so that's what I would say is a way of understanding the scriptures are this incredible metaphor, but it's like Bruce Lee says in Enter the Dragon, they're like a finger pointing away to the moon. Don't focus on the finger or you'll miss all that heavenly glory. They're a metaphor. They're pointing you to something else, and you're not supposed to focus in on trying to figure out literally that there was 12 disciples or literally that there was a prophet, Elisha, you know, who could call bears out of the forest to tear children apart. That's horrific. But it's only horrific if it's literal. It's actually a metaphor for the motions of the stars. And in fact, that's what connects it to all the other myths of the world, because the Osiris and Isis and Set and Horus are all talking about the motions of the heavenly bodies. The Norse gods of Odin and Freya and Loki are all talking about the heavenly motions of the stars, the moon, the sun, and the planets. And all of those things are metaphors that are there to teach us something really profound. So,
yeah, I agree with you, man. And it's really important to really think about that, because this isn't just about a couple of stories in the Bible. I mean, this was a systematic program to change the way humanity thinks forever. A lot of that esoteric knowledge, a lot of that, the message behind the literal story was completely lost. And it's taken schools and generations of this, state schooling and getting these little worker bees to be task-oriented, left-brain thinkers. And a lot of our ability to understand those coded messages has been weeded out of humanity. And that is the real crime.
Yeah, no, for sure. Look, if you go to someone who knows the truth and then they give you falsehood, and you're like an honest seeker trying to figure out your life, and they tell you something deliberately false, that seems to me to be a real thought crime, right? But it is possible that a lot of the people who are perpetuating this system do truly believe it the way that they're teaching it. I think there's probably people at the top who know, just like in lots of other systems, where there may be lots of people who are genuinely and sincerely thinking that they're doing what's right. But maybe they're being, you know, you might talk about like the police forces who are marching down the street wearing body armor, right? Do you think those guys go to work every day thinking, I'm a tyrant, you know? when your kids ask what they do, I'm a tool of tyranny. No, that's not what they're thinking. They're sincerely thinking, I'm protecting the people, I'm enforcing law and order, whatever. Right. So I think there's a lot of people who may be I'm just trying to put it's not all black and white, but true. I do believe that the people at the top are maybe using the misguided efforts of the sincere believers and pointing them in bad or directions that could be ultimately harmful. And I'll say this other thing too, is that, like I said, I took the scriptures literally for 20 years, and not because I was trying to be a bad person, but because it explained a lot. It had a lot of value and positive impact on my life. Well, if it can have that kind of value and positive impact and deep, profound meaning on your life when you're taking it on a level that I believe now is only the superficial level, the, you know, maybe even the counterfeit explanation. If the counterfeit is that positive and life-changing for many people, what could the real... the real thing must have been really good if the counterfeit could hold sway. Look, this is a system that's held sway for 17 centuries at least. So you can't fool people with just pure poison. You got to use what I believe is being done is a counterfeit is being offered. Anyway, so does that kind of respond to what you were saying there?
Yeah, absolutely, man. And, I mean, let's look at some of the examples, because let's say, okay, so this realization that the biblical stories are really just metaphors about the movement of stars and the constellations through the 12 houses of the zodiac rather than 12 tribes of Israel or Jesus, aka the sun, and 12 apostles. You know, if we start to have this realization that it's more about what's happening in space from the human perspective rather than literal tribes or literal apostles. I mean, so what? What does that really mean to anyone listening today? What kind of value should be attained from that realization?
Exactly. Okay. So, yeah, so we'll throw in a few, we'll do a few examples to show. But before we do that, let's just get to that question that you ended your question with, which is, so what? It's like, remember when Bruce Lee had the finger pointing to the moon, he said, don't focus on the finger or you'll miss all that heavenly glory. What, the moon? So now I'm supposed to focus in on the moon? Well, the moon is a large literal rock, right? The moon is this large spherical object made up of certain chemicals that is hurtling around in a circle around the earth. What does that have to do with my, why should the finger be pointing to that, right? Well, the moon itself is a metaphor. So if all these cultures around the world are revering sacred stories and sacred scriptures that have to do with the motions of the heavenly bodies, and I can demonstrate to you that they are, all the cultures around the world are revering a set of scriptures that have to do with the heavenly bodies. Why is that? Those motions of those heavenly bodies must be pretty important. They must be telling us something very profound about the human consciousness or the human existence. And in fact, we must somehow be connected to those stars and heavenly bodies in some way that we can tease out. So now let me just show you a couple examples.
Sure.
And the Bible, you know, I spend the most amount of time in the Undying Stars showing how this or that biblical story relates to the stars. But let me just say, this is not something new, as you've already alluded to. Even in the ancient times, there was this great writer, he's also been called the first writer of science fiction, Lucian of Samosata, who way back in like the first century said, these stories are all about the story of Venus having an affair with Mars, while her husband Vulcan in Roman was away. So Vulcan or Hephaestus in Greek was the smith of the gods, and he could make, you know, he had a forge and he forged a web, a net to catch his wife. His wife was Venus or Aphrodite, the love goddess. But she, you know, he was crippled because his father Zeus or Jupiter had thrown him out of Olympus and all the way down to Earth and broke both of his legs. So he was kind of this very plodding figure, and Venus or Aphrodite is always having an affair with Mars, Ares, the war god. You know, he's like the captain of the football team in high school. He's like the fastest runner, and she's always sneaking off to bed with him when Vulcan is out of town. So he comes up with it, and this is in the Odyssey, he comes up with this plot to trick her. And he rigs up this fine gossamer web, so strong that you can't break out of it, but it's almost invisible. Even the gods can't see it. And he rigs it up above their bed. And then he says, I'm going off on a business trip. Some of my worshipers off in this far island. I'll be back in a few weeks. And he heads out the door. And then this, his friend, the sun, Helios, is going to keep an eye on things and let him know. And no sooner is Vulcan or Hephaestus out the door than Ares comes in and says to Aphrodite, all right, he's gone. Let's head off to bed. And they do. And they spend the night together in lovemaking and fall asleep. And as they fall asleep, the net comes down over them. And Helios says to Vulcan or Hephaestus, hey, time to come back now. And he comes back and he finds that, you know, they're trapped. They can't move. They're like, ugh. And the husband is roaring in anguish. And he calls all the gods together. He says, come look at this. You know, why should I have to endure this? And all the gods are there. They're laughing at Mars and Venus trapped underneath the web. And they said, oh, it looks like the slow guy caught the captain of the football team there, huh, Mars? And then Hermes, the trickster god, the Mercury, says, hey, you know, I'd trade places with Ares, even if I was trapped underneath the web, just to be next to Venus. I don't care if all the gods are looking at me. So they're making fun of him. But Lucian of Samosata said, this story that is well known and remembered and preserved in the Odyssey is actually about the planets Mars and Venus when they have a conjunction together. And maybe the planet Saturn is heading off as this conjunction is happening. And they're having the conjunction in the Pleiades. And the Pleiades, or the Pleiades, are these beautiful cluster of shimmering stars right above the shoulder of Taurus, the bull, in the zodiac. And in the zodiac, all the planets actually pass through the zodiac. The zodiac are those constellations that are arrayed along the ecliptic path that all the planets and the sun and the moon generally travel along. So the planets will go through the zodiac just like the sun will. And so I actually have a blog post from a few years ago when there was this conjunction taking place in the Pleiades. And by the way, the sun was coming up. Well, in the story, who catches them in bed? Who's the lookout? It's the sun. Mm-hmm. And it's in the morning when the sun comes up that all the gods come around and laugh at the situation. Well, that's an example of how these myths embody a celestial motion. And the motion of in this case, the sun and certain planets, which, by the way, all the planets have the names of the gods. If you read Hamlet's Mill, they put forth this, and it was written in 1969, they put forth this theory that the planets were not named after the gods, which is what we're usually taught.
Mm-hmm.
No, the gods are actually named after the planets, or the gods are telling the story of the motions of these planets moving through the background of these stars. And that is in Greek mythology. So now let's just quickly jump over to the Bible, and you've got the motion of the 12 tribes of Israel that go down to Egypt, where they're in bondage, they're in slavery, they're making bricks for the Pharaoh, right? Like in what was that animated version of the Prince of Egypt, right? Where Moses has to lead the 12 tribes up out of the bondage down in Egypt, up into the promised land. Well, there's 12 tribes of Israel. Tribes are groupings, and there's 12 constellations of the zodiac. And in fact, in the Old Testament, there are two different places where the tribes, the 12 children of Israel, are given a blessing. Each tribe is given a different blessing, and those blessings identify which zodiac constellation that tribe represents. And I talk about that in the book. But like for an easy one, the clearest and most obvious is Judah is the lion. He's described as the lion or the child of a lion or the whelp of a lion, you know, a young lion. And that's Leo. Okay. But they all actually relate to a tribe. And Moses leads, he's the constellation or he is the constellation that leads the tribes up out of the lower half of the year. As we all know, you know, if you go surfing in the morning, there's part of the year where the nights are longer than the days, where the sun doesn't come up until, you know, much later during the winter. And then in the summer, we've got the sun is up at night until almost 9 o'clock. But in the winter, it might be getting dark at 4 o'clock. So half of the year, days are longer than nights, and half of the year, nights are longer than days. In that lower half of the year, we enter that at the September equinox, when the sun crosses over to being in the shorter half of the year, where the days are suddenly shorter than the nights, and they keep getting, the days keep getting shorter all the way down to that bottom winter solstice, which is like the very pit, the lowest part of the year for the sun. And the sun is lowest in the sky on that day. And then they start to ascend back up towards the summer solstice, but it's still, days are still shorter until we get to that spring equinox. And that's where we cross over into the upper half of the year. And so the crossing out of Egypt, what happens in that crossing point is they cross the Red Sea, and Moses leads them across the Red Sea. Now we're out of Egypt. We're up, heading up into the Promised Land. And Moses is actually associated with the constellation Aries, I believe, which is the ram, which he is the one that leads the zodiac wheel up into the upper half of the year in the age of Aries. And you can tell that Moses is associated with Aries because he has, in artistic depictions going back centuries, ram's horns. Yeah. You may wonder, why is Michelangelo's Moses have ram's horns? Why are all these drawings of Moses have little horns? Because he's associated with Aries, the constellation that is right there at the March equinox, he's leading the zodiac up out of the lower half of the year. And as they continue to go up, then we have this incident with the golden calf, where his brother Aaron, you know, Moses is up on the mountain going up to get the Ten Commandments. And as he comes down, he sees, to his horror, while he was gone, his brother Aaron has talked all the Israelites into making a golden calf and starting to worship that and saying and dancing around and chanting, "These, O Israel, are your gods that led you up out of the land of Egypt." And he smashes the Ten Commandment tablets and says, "What are you doing? Melt down that calf, and God's about to send a plague and everybody's going to suffer for doing this." Why? Because Aaron and the Israelites were declaring that a calf, a bull, the likeness of a young Taurus, led them up out of the land of Egypt. And Moses says, "Hold on, wrong answer. That was the age of Taurus. That's over. We're in the age of Aries now. Get a clue." And the Old Testament scriptures depict the children of Israel having they use ram's horns, you know, the shofar. Mm-hmm. It's a very sacred symbol. It's a very sacred sound. They blow the shofar, at very specific times. It's the symbology is of the age of Aries. So long story short, we could go through the whole Bible and find connections just like that. If that was just one isolated, like, ooh, gee whiz, there's this one little coincidence, but it goes through, you know, I show pretty many of these on the blog with, right, Samson, or with, in the New Testament, you've got the 12 disciples. In the book of Revelation, you've got some very clear celestial imagery going on. It's not just a one-off. It's actually, this is the central underlying foundation of the house that it's built upon.
Yeah, man, I think it's all super interesting. And another thing on the precession of the equinoxes is you also talk about how this is the basis for the concept of heaven and hell. And this is absolutely key for the elite to establish, because if you want to control someone's life, you've got to convince them that there is something better than this life, or far worse, on the other side, and that you have the key. And it sounds so impossible, but somehow that trick worked, and it's still working today. But this concept of heaven and hell was really just a warping of this knowledge, which was known, which was called the precession of the equinoxes, and still is, right? I mean, there's a connection there, right?
Yeah, so you're getting, now you're really, that's a perceptive, you know, question to ask right here, because what you're getting into really is the concept of controlling other people, right? What you just said was, you got to have something to hold over their heads. You've got to have something to use as a lever. Mm-hmm. And you can always use just brute force, right? Do this or I will hit you with a baseball bat. But that's expensive, right? You got to maintain a lot of people with a lot of baseball bats. And there's always the danger that, you know, if you're a small group trying to control the large group, eventually the large group might wake up and say, you know what? There's a lot of us and a few of them, right? So let's use something other than just brute force. Let's use, yeah, we'll back it up with brute force at the end, but it's a lot more efficient, a lot more effective, and a lot less expensive if we can say, you better listen to me, or, you know, if you disobey me, you'll go to hell. Ooh, okay. I don't know that I believe that, but just in case, I guess I better, you know, hedge my bets. So that's like the ultimate sanction, right? Eternal damnation for your soul. But there's other lesser ways that forms of control other than brute force go along with a system. So these systems control people by getting them to buy into, or getting them to believe, or getting them to agree to a certain way of looking at the world. And if once you start to look at the world that way, then you start to actually act as if it really is that way. It makes it a lot easier for the people who've kind of created the maze, right, for the rats to run around in. So it's a form of control through anything other than physical force. We could say, broadly speaking, is mind control. I don't mean mind control as in I say a word and you turn into a mindless zombie that does whatever I say. Well, that would be an extreme form of mind control. But anything that doesn't rely on me, you know, threatening to shoot you, hey, give me your money now, I've got a gun, that would be physical. But anything else is basically controlling you through your mind. And so this is this is a form two questions ago, it was, well, so what? Actually, I would say all these things are actually supposed to be teaching us human freedom, higher consciousness, how to be empowered, the wondrousness of each individual and the incredible power that you have. That's what they're really teaching, but they've been turned into by some people, a form of doing the exact opposite, of controlling you, of limiting you, of putting you in a box. And then you brought up, so the precession of the equinoxes is just another cycle. So we may not all be familiar with the precessional cycle. That's a big cycle. It actually takes nearly 25,000 years if it were to play all the way out, which, you know, we could... But let's dial down to let's dial down to a daily cycle, right? We're all familiar with the sun rises in the east, and because of the turning of the earth, right? Those of us in North America know that the east coast, it's turning towards the east coast, so they get there first, so they see the sunrise first, right? On New Year's Eve, they see the ball drop 3 hours before those of us on the west coast do. So, but eventually, I'm going to continue turning towards the east, and then eventually that turning will cause the sun to seem to go down into the west, into the Pacific Ocean. For those of us who are sitting out there, you know, in the water, staring out into the Pacific, we'll see the sun eventually sink down into the ocean, right? So that motion is a daily cycle. Then we've got monthly cycles that the moon, you know, the moon goes through this monthly cycle where it goes to a new moon, then it gets fuller and fuller to a full moon. And then there's annual cycles, which we talked about, you know, the days get shorter, we go all the way to a, and then there's even longer than yearly cycles. There's other cycles that the moon does but there's this precessional cycle, which actually has to do with, you can only detect it if you watch the background stars that the sun rises in. So on any specific day of the year, at the exact same moment in time, the sun, if you're at the exact same point on the planet, the sun's going to rise on the same, with the same background of stars. It's going to rise out of the same background of stars. And over the year, it's going to rise in a different background of stars. But when the Earth gets back around to the exact same point, it should be rising in the exact same group of stars. But over a long, long period of time, the background of stars will actually be delayed. There'll be this slippage where the background of stars is getting delayed by the motion of precession, which is a physics term that has to do with the top of the the top of the axis of the Earth is precessing. It's doing this wobble. It's just like in physics mm-hmm. class where the teacher might suspend a bicycle wheel from a string and then he spins it around to show angular momentum, or a gyroscope when it starts to wobble. So that's what causes the precessional cycle. But that cycle too, all these myths are showing these cycles, are embodying all these cycles from the daily cycle to the precessional cycle. But they're saying this has to do with human existence. Actually, what we're trying to teach you is actually that there's a cycle to human existence where we come down into an incarnated state. And let me just say real quick, whether or not we believe this is one thing, but I believe that one of the purposes for using all these celestial metaphors is because this is what they're trying to say. The human spirit is kind of like that sun. It goes up into the air where it's not embodied, but then it hits the earth. It sinks down into the west and it plows through the earth and the water. It plows through the clay of the it when it hits the western horizon and sinks down into the underworld. That's kind of like a spirit coming down out of the world of disembodied fire and into a body made of earth and water. That is a mm-hmm. man or woman made of clay. You know, we're a mixture of earth and water. Well, but we've got this fire inside of us. That's this divine spark. It's like the sun. We are kind of like the sun, Osiris, in the underworld. We're like the sun when it hits the western horizon. That's the point of birth, because that's when the fire, the spark, the spirit comes down into a human body, and then it plows through this human existence of being inside this body. Oh man, my finger hurts or whatever, you know, I'm in a body. But mm-hmm. then at the eastern horizon, that's the end of the incarnational cycle. But there's something that lives on after that. That's the spirit. There's actually part of us that is not physical. At least, you know, that's one way of interpreting what these metaphors are pointing to. And actually, there's lots that backs that up. For instance, if somebody has a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience, that shows, or that could be interpreted as showing, that there's a part of human consciousness that actually can exist somehow independently of the body, right? And then maybe it comes back mm-hmm. into the body. So I've kind of thrown out a lot there, but that's, you know, that's one possible teaching, that these cycles, when you say, well, the precessional cycle or the solar cycle, what does it all mean? You know, so what? Why would you put that into a myth? Because we're trying to say this is what human life is like. But you said, but wait, they're turning that into a method of mind control. They're talking about hell. Well, hell is actually, sure, the Bible talks about hell and it says don't end up in hell where the fire consumes you forever. Oh, that's really scary. What are they talking about? I better not mess up. I better not sin. I better not do this thing. You know, I'm being threatened that I'll go to hell if I do this lifestyle. Wait a minute. That's a total misinterpretation. Hell is actually that lower half of the zodiac wheel. Hell is the part of the year from when the September solstice, for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it's the September solstice. Down, guys in Australia, this is reversed. But that at September solstice is where the night starts to take over. That's where nighttime starts to dominate daytime. That's where darkness starts to rule. Guess what? That's hell. That's Hades for Greek mythology. That's Sheol in the Old Testament. That's the underworld of Osiris in ancient Egypt. That is a metaphor for a half of the year. But then we mm-hmm. come up at the March equinox. Suddenly we start heading up towards heaven. That's the high part of the year. That's where days are longest. That's where we get all the way to the top, to the shining city on the hill, that heavenly Jerusalem, where the streets are paved with gold. These are all metaphors to reflect sunshine. That's the top of the year. That's the the top of the zodiac wheel, the summer solstice, right? That's where the sun is the highest. That's the upper half of the zodiac wheel, and that's heaven. And so the whole idea of heaven and hell as this form of a punishment or reward is it's taking literally something that's actually a metaphor that's teaching something much different. It's actually teaching reincarnation, or at least it could be argued mm-hmm. that it's teaching reincarnation. It's not teaching eternal hellfire. So
right. Yeah, man, it's super fascinating. And another aspect of this literalism interpretation of ancient text that I wanted to ask you about that's been cropping up a lot more in recent years, especially in the alternative community, is you start to see people who are looking at these older texts and biblical passages as literal to support the ancient alien theory, that some of these teachers were aliens and genetically alternated primitive humans to get what we have today. But I guess you would probably disagree with that interpretation, right? Because you see it as all esoteric.
Yeah, so great, great question. You're a great researcher, Greg. Yeah, so that is a form of taking them literally, right? We've got in the book of Genesis, we have this passage in Genesis 6 about the sons of heaven who, you know, saw the women on earth, that they were desirable, and they came down and had, you know, races of giants, you know, that were the offspring of this kind of divine being having, you know, sexual relations with a human woman, okay? Is that supposed to be taken literally? Well, look, people could argue that. And we also have the Anunnaki in the Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian mythology. Now, I believe that I've found so much evidence to support the metaphorical celestial, and it's not just me. Like I just said, this goes mm-hmm. all the way back to guys in ancient times were saying this. There were writers in the 1800s who were talking about what they called astronomico theology. Now we usually shorten it to astrotheology. Or there's, you know, great teachers. Like, I want to just give a shout out to Santos Bonacci. He's a wonderful teacher who has great videos on the internet that explain this very same system that I'm talking about. So there's so yeah. much evidence that it's celestial that we have to be careful. I would always say, let's look and see if there's a celestial explanation before we start to buy the literal explanation. But it could be argued, or somebody who believes that, you know, the Anunnaki are literal beings that had sex with women, or maybe did genetic engineering on them. Maybe the sex is a metaphor for genetic engineering or whatever. But wait, let's not. We could believe both. We could say, look, it's both metaphorical and it literally happened. Look, I'm not going to, and my position is, okay, I'm like Sherlock Holmes or Scooby-Doo coming up to the mystery. I'm looking at the clues. I'm not going to throw out any possible explanation if the clues support it. So I am not here to bash someone else's interpretation of the clues, but I would say, well, wait a minute, let's see if we can explain it a different way. You know, maybe the way that these mm-hmm. people are explaining it is a possibility, but could it also be that the events happened like this? Okay, so with that said, I can't look back much. I can't use these. I don't believe that these texts should be used for history. I believe these texts are metaphorical. So when somebody starts to support history, like 2000 BC with these texts,
it gets a little hairy.
Yeah, we're going too far. It's like saying, well, look, I know there were people in the land of Judea during the Roman Empire, because historically we know that the Romans had a campaign against Judea. Okay, and we know those people were there for a certain period of time in advance. But if you say, and by the way, the Exodus proves that they were there in about 2000 BC or whatever, I say, well, wait a minute, you just brought in, you know, the Exodus in the coming up out of Egypt, which I just showed you could also be completely talking about what the stars mm-hmm. are doing. So when we go all the way back to the Anunnaki, you know, in some thousands and thousands of years BC, and we're using the text as our primary evidence, then I would say, well, that's problematic. I'm going to say I'm agnostic about things that are, after a certain point, we get into really, really remote mm-hmm. history where I can't look. I can look back. So in my book, I'm only making kind of definitive statements, historically speaking, from about the time of, well, you know, ancient Egypt, ancient Greece. What happened before that, like in man's distant past before the Egyptians, it's clearly extremely important. Something very, very amazing was going on back then that is different from what we're taught in conventional history. So where did these texts come from? You know, how did the ancient Egyptians have them? How did the ancient Sumerians have them? Because these texts show evidence of, you know, knowledge of quantum physics. These texts show evidence of, you know, sophisticated understandings of how the world works that modern science didn't start to really encounter until the 20th mm-hmm. century. So how did that happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. And so my position is, I don't know what happened. I know that something happened. So it could be that it was Anunnaki or people from another or beings from another planet. That is a possible explanation to this Scooby-Doo mystery. But I've got to see the evidence. And so if I can go to the Anunnaki legends or myths and show a celestial explanation for them, then I've got to say, well, it could be also literal, but it's definitely celestial. Mm-hmm. It could be celestial and literal. It could be more than just celestial, but it's definitely not less. So it's, yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but I do think you got to be careful of literalism, because that has been the major obstacle to seeing the profound truths of the metaphorical. Mm-hmm. These things are metaphorical, and if you take them only literally, you're going to miss all that.
Right.
If you spend all your time watching The Matrix trying to figure out, okay, which city is Neo from, it's like, why are you watching it for history? You're missing it. Same thing with these texts. Well, you can also miss the metaphorical in a different way than it's been missed for the last 17 centuries by saying, oh yeah, this is all about aliens, literal this, literal that. And once again, we've lost the metaphor. So if the metaphorical is actually the key to tremendous power, then the people who want to keep that key out of people's hands will keep it out anyway. Anything that keeps you from the metaphorical, that's fine.
Yeah,
So, hey, man, I'll keep you from the metaphorical by believing that it's literal 12 disciples, literal miracles in the New Testament books of the Gospels, literal, 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 don't take it celestially, literal prophet Elijah, literal prophet Elisha, literal 12. Okay, that's one way to miss the metaphor. Now, after that metaphor has started to fall apart and more people are not believing it anymore, hey, let's bring in a totally different literal ancient aliens, literal travelers in spaceships that came down. Oh, all these things in the Old Testament, oh, they're describing spaceships, they're describing rockets, they're describing literal, literal, literal. Okay, miss the metaphor again.
Yeah, I appreciate that position. And on the subject of these stories being esoteric, a lot of people tend to think that esoteric messages are meant to keep something hidden, but I've heard you talk about it as more of a way to reveal information, of course, like you've been saying today, rather than conceal it. And it's just that we don't cultivate the type of thinking that appreciates symbolism as much as the ancients might have. It might have seemed much simpler to them.
Yeah, so I didn't come up with that idea myself either. That comes from this great writer named R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, who wrote all in French. He was Alsatian. And John Anthony West actually wrote this book in the 70s called Serpent in the Sky, which mm-hmm. was kind of like the first introduction of a lot of English-speaking people to the work of Schwaller de Lubitsch, and it's fantastic stuff. So one of Schwaller de Lubitsch's books, now they've been translated into English, talks about the esoteric and what is it for? And one of the things that he said really struck me, where he said, you know, we always think of the esoteric as a way of hiding, as a way of concealing. And it does, you know, you might say, oh yeah, that the Moses and the, you know, the ram and the Taurus, whoa, that I didn't see that. That was hidden. Yeah, they were, that was a hidden message. It is, in a way, you could think of the esoteric as a hidden message, but he said, no, it's not a way of hiding. It's a way of conveying. And I wrote this blog post about wax on, wax off.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, in The Karate Kid, the first Karate Kid, where Mr. Miyagi and Daniel-san is like doing all these chores, and he doesn't know that there's a hidden meaning, right? Why did Mr. Miyagi teach him that way? Well, it's a way of conveying, it's a way of teaching Daniel-san something that he might not have been able to grasp or absorb any other way. So he had him wax on, wax off. He's waxed the car, then he's paint the fence, then he's paint the house. And each time he's doing a different motion. And after a while, he goes up to Mr. Miyagi and says, hey man, I thought you were going to teach me karate. I'm in real trouble here. Don't you see I'm getting beaten up every day? You promised to teach me, and you just got me acting as your slave. And Mr. Miyagi says, hold on. And then he doesn't explain it to him. He just shows him. He doesn't say, you know all those things? I told you that esoterically. No, he just throws a punch at him and says, show me, wax on, wax off. And he shows, and suddenly Daniel knows it on a deeper way than he could have ever known it before. Because if Mr. Miyagi had just said, okay, Daniel-san, I see you're having some trouble. Your girlfriend, the girl you like, you know, the guy who likes her happens to be
Cobra Kai.
Cobra Kai guy who kicks your butt every day. Now, I'm going to tell you how to stop one of those tremendous velocity spinning kicks that that guy knows how to do. What I want you to do is this particular motion, and the angle of your elbow is really important. You got to get it right to here. And when you see that kick starting, here's when you put your hand and you move it like this. And Daniel-san's sitting there going, okay, well, I'm trying to keep it. And then doubts will start to creep into Daniel-san's mind immediately. Like, wait a minute, I felt some of those kicks. those kicks come really, really hard. And by the way, what if I'm thinking of blocking the left foot and he's doing a fake and he blocks and he kicks a right? What will happen then? And Daniel-san's left brain, which is a useful tool that we've been given that is useful for all kinds of things that Daniel-san is using it for in high school, is not very useful for learning karate. And Mr. Miyagi knows that. So he says, Daniel-san, let me put your left brain to sleep for a little while. I want you to wax these cars for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And so Daniel-san's left brain goes off into La La Land and starts daydreaming while he's just absorbing this motion. And then Mr. Miyagi shows him that motion is not just about wax the car. That's the literal motion. That's the literal level. These scriptures are not just about a cool story. They are telling you kung fu. It's like Neo goes, well, I know kung fu, right? They're, and all of a sudden, Daniel-san realizes he knows something deep in his bones that he couldn't have gotten maybe any other way, or at least that's a depiction. So when R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch said the esoteric is actually to teach, it's not to hide, Mr. Miyagi didn't use wax on, wax off to hide something from Daniel-san. He did it to bypass the parts of Daniel-san that wouldn't accept it, or the parts of Daniel-san that would slow him down. And it's like, look, I'm going to use the esoteric not to hide this stuff from you, but to teach it to you. And I'm going to get it, but there's all these defenses and there's all these roadblocks. So I've got to send it to you in a little seed. And once the seed's in your brain, then boom, it's going to grow into this tree. But I can't send the tree into your brain because all your defenses will stop it. So I'm going to send it in as this seed, and then the hidden part will come out and blossom. So that's what the esoteric is. So that's what all these stories are, actually a way of teaching us stuff maybe that we would balk at, or that we would choke on, that our brain would go, oh man, I can't accept that. But then it's a way of showing us kung fu. It's a way of teaching us kung fu through wax on, wax off. But then along came, as you mentioned, the Cobra Kai. There's people who want to use karate or kung fu to beat you up. There's people who want to use it to oppress, you know, to keep everyone down in the school. Like, hey, don't mess with me or or we'll find you after school and beat you up. So this knowledge can be used for tremendous empowerment and helping the individual to stand up against tyranny, or it can be used to tyrannize. And what the Cobra Kai school could have done, you know, at some point in the past, was go around and find all the Mr. Miyagis who are teaching the good side and say, hey, you better stop that. And hey, have you got any books that explain the interpretation of these wax on, wax off motions and how they translate into Kung Fu? Good. We'll take those. We'll keep some copies for ourselves and we'll burn the rest so that humanity cannot know that this stuff is esoteric. And that's what happened in the Roman Empire. You can see this going on where texts are being suppressed because those are the texts that teach, hey, this stuff's all esoteric. This stuff's all Gnostic. This stuff is all not literal. This stuff is all talking about metaphors, and all those texts were it was pain of death to have them. It was like, you know, it was a death penalty. So we've actually found some of these texts that have been buried and hidden. There's a set of texts called the Nag Hammadi library that was dug up from near Alexandria, where probably, you know, when the edict came out that you could no longer have these Gnostic texts, they didn't want to burn them, but they also didn't want to get caught with them. So they buried them, maybe intending to come back later. And for whatever reason, they never did. And in the 20th century, they were found. And people said, wow, this shows that actually Christianity, this literalistic Christianity, has always said that the Gnostics were like this, you know, this heretical sect. But actually, what this shows is that the Gnostic interpretation was that was the original, or that was the primary, that was the way it was supposed to be understood, and then it got stamped out, or at least that's one way that this Nag Hammadi discovery has been interpreted. But I would say it's like the people trying to stamp out, certain people wanted to just keep the Kung Fu to themselves and make sure that everybody else, when they're reading or doing wax on, wax off, there was always a teacher standing by to say, and by the way, don't get any funny ideas that waxing that car might relate to karate or Kung Fu. It is only waxing the car. And if you say any otherwise, you're a heretic.
Some people think that's why Bruce Lee was killed, too. He brought all that over to America, started teaching things that they didn't want taught.
Wow.
But it's interesting, man. That's a great analogy. I love the whole Karate Kid thing. I love the explanation of the esoteric tools, the way that that type of learning is supposed to, you know, be taken in. And, you know, now it's been warped by the elite, and now it's a mind control tool in the nightstand of hotels across America. Funny how things turn out.
Well, it's in the nightstands, but it's there for you to look at it. And if you look at it long enough, you might, you know, at least there's not standing by the nightstand, there's not a person saying, do you have any questions about that? Oh, no, that can't be it, right? It's there for, it was actually illegal to put this stuff into the vulgar languages of the people for many centuries. It was death penalty by horrendous means. If you translated these words into English or into French, it had to be in, you know, languages that the people generally couldn't understand. So you could also say that the impulse to put it on the nightstands across the country is actually stemming from the idea that, hey, these words actually do have revolutionary power to help the individual. And I will say, you know, to your point about killing someone for teaching the truth, how horrendous is that to say, to ever argue that it could possibly be okay to kill someone for an idea or for what they say, right? You know, use of force, and Mark Passio talks about this. I don't know if you've ever had him on your show. I've listened to, you know, some of your episodes, but, you know, he talks about this. Force is not always wrong. If somebody is running at you with a knife raised in the air and they're a terrible expression on their face that they're about to stab it into your forehead and screaming and they're coming at you full speed and you don't think you can get away any other way than to actually physically engage that guy and stop him, there's nothing wrong with doing that. You're protecting, you've got this human body that is this amazing thing. We can talk about how the human body is a microcosm of the whole universe, and this guy's threatening to pull the plug on it. You have every right to stop him by the use of force, and that's not violence. But if somebody walks up to you in a you know, on the streets of the city and says to you, I believe this, and you hit him over the head with, you know, then it's violence because you're actually violating his right. How could it ever be right to use force against someone who's just trying to teach an idea? See, that's where,
agreed,
you know, it's so horrible. You know, like, yeah. I just wanted to get that out. Like, how could anyone ever teach that killing over quote unquote heresy could ever be right? You know, that is such an abomination. So anyway,
I'm with you, man. But David, man, it has been a real blast. I think you make a great case, and I really respect your journey from eating up the literalist perspective, hook, line, and sinker, to coming out the complete other direction and being on the forefront of alternative research. It could not have been easy, man. But before we go, do you want to tell the people a little bit more about your blog or anything else you're working on, where they can get your book and keep up with your work?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So I just want to first say it's been my pleasure, and I want to really commend you and wish you the best with the Higher Side Chat's success. I know it's already successful, right?
But thanks, man.
But
thanks.
I just want to say my view of what you're doing is fighting on the side of knowledge. What we just said was the most important thing. You're on the side of higher consciousness and waking up, right?
Yeah.
So that's the forefront of the battle, what you're doing right there. So by making this platform and airing out all these different views, and of course you're going to get some different views here, there, and everywhere, but you're making a place for people to go hear them. Mm-hmm. So that's fantastic, and I just want to commend you for that.
Thanks,
so,
man.
Yeah, so I encourage everybody, and I'm going to be a regular listener to both hours. So, you know, what I've heard so far, I've listened to a bunch, and I love them. I love your style and the research that you do. So, to find out or to get the book, you can go to your local bookstore and ask for it and say, hey, I'd like to get The Undying Stars. I mean, you can buy, support whatever channel you want to support. If you want to get it through Amazon, if that's the easiest and cheapest place for you and the fastest shipping, then do that. If you want to support your local bookstore and say, hey, have you heard of The Undying Stars? You can get it from anyone who sells books. We'll order it, should be able to order it for you with no problem. It's called The Undying Stars. You can easily find, I've got a blog where there's just lots of 3.5 years worth of free content you can read and search, and there's indexes in there to over 50 different star myths that I've from all different mythologies that I've linked to and explained, hey, this is the constellations that it links to. So that blog is easy enough to find. It's called The Matheson Corollary because that was the title of my first book. And when I started this blog, it was right when I published my first book, The Matheson Corollary. But you can easily find it just by spelling my name into any search engine, as you see it up on the screen here on the Higher Side Chats. If you just spell my name right and put David Matheson Stars or just David Matheson, you should find my blog as one of the top search results. But my website is davidmatheson.com. We'll get you there. The blog is called The Matheson Corollary, and there's lots of, I hope, interesting and informative stuff there for people to check out. So,
right on. Well, very cool, man. Thanks so much for your kind words and for joining me on the show. It has been great. I mean, it is a consciousness war, and our numbers are growing every day. So keep doing what you do and take care of yourself out there.
Thanks a lot, Greg. It's been a pleasure to make your acquaintance first and to get to talk to you. Fantastic conversation.
Likewise, man. Thanks again. Whoa, folks. Just whoa. I really enjoyed that show. David is a good dude, and I think he makes some great movie analogies, which is really important in my book. But his book is pretty good for anyone interested. Several interesting aspects, some we didn't get to talk about. One of them was on the subject of waves and the importance of frequency, where they have these super thin plates that you can place sand on and hit it with a certain frequency, and you'll always get the same pattern. And when you look at these patterns and compare them to ancient carvings and representations of Medusa and the Green Man, they look almost identical, as if they were drawing these faces in a way of representing that frequency. Really interesting stuff. You can find more about that in The Undying Stars, David's book. And if you enjoyed the first hour with David, you can pick up THC Plus and get the extended show. In this episode, during the extended show, we expanded more on what the secrets of these ancient texts really reveal, what David describes as the shamanic holographic universe. He elaborates on quantum physics, breaks down the Higher Side Chats, and outlines the shamanic journey that is the Lego Movie. And most importantly, the story of Josephus, Mithraism, and the infiltration of the Roman Empire by these members of Mithraism. And to me, that's huge. There is a huge amount of manipulation involved that has had far-reaching effects. I mean, we might not have gotten to the top of the pyramid in this conversation, but we got pretty close. That said, thanks for listening, everyone. We made it through the end of August without any major disasters. Praise Allah for that. And I hope the three-day weekend for Labor Day was great for all the folks who have that kind of job. And I hope you're all on the path to demanding more out of your life. And instead of waiting for success to show up on the doorstep, you're actively pushing towards the fulfillment of your dreams and life path. And you're doing what thou wilt and whatnot. And as this show closes out, think about what you're going to do next. Make it something to better your life. Create something that makes you feel good, impress your partner with some random romance, meditate, or at least get down on the ground and do 50 push-ups or something. Anything so that you're a slightly more accurate reflection of the fractal nature of this goddamn perfect universe than you were before. There is a reality out there where you are the cock of the walk, baby. The smartest, most charming, charismatic, ripped, intelligent person in the room with the washboard abs of Zac Efron. Or for the ladies, the thigh gap of all thigh gaps. That reality exists. Start pulling yourself into it right now, and I'll see you there when you arrive. But hopefully we learned a little something today, or were reminded of truth we sometimes forget or marginalize as unimportant when its effects on our global culture are as severe as ever. Thanks again to David and all of you. You're making my dreams come true, and I suppose that's it for me this week. I won't take up any more of your valuable time. We both know you got to get out there and own this fucking day. So play on, player. Here's an inspirational and enlightening track from our previous guest, the mathemagician Marty Leeds. This one is called Song for the Daemon, and I'll see you next week. Your move, members of the Mithraic Mystery Schools. Your fucking move.
I got a devil on my left and an angel on my right. My shoulders have been keeping me up all night, and I'm trying to find my way through the darkness and light. Riding on the rails of a train going to ride, crying and laughing, man, the whole damn time. And one of these days, maybe myself, I'll just find. What's below?